WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm going to ask you to do something right now. Cast your mind back 10 years ago to the fall of 2008. The campaign debates between John McCain and Barack Obama are going on.
Tumbled more than 500 points.
And in the headlines, it seemed that life in America was hanging in the balance.
We saw financial market turmoil reach a new level last week and spill over into the rest of the economy. We must now take further decisive action to fundamentally and comprehensively address.
I had covered the Iraq War. I spent a year in Baghdad. I would say, in many ways, that week felt scarier. And then I'd go out and everyone's just going shopping, walking down the street. Nobody has any idea that their fundamental way of life is really hanging by a thread.
Adam Davidson is now a staff writer at The New Yorker, but during the housing crisis and the market crash of 2008, he was the co-host of NPR's show Planet Money. He recently revisited that critical, terrifying, decisive moment with Hank Paulson. Paulson then was Treasury Secretary under George Bush.
For you and I, we lived in that crisis second by second, and it's seared in our brains, I think. You know, that week of September 15th, you could, you know, what was happening Thursday at 3, and I could probably tell you.
And as everything was collapsing, it was Paulson's job, basically, to save the world.
I describe it sometimes. The week that Lehman went down and we had to step in and prevent a very disastrous failure of AIG from happening. And if we'd had one more institution go down, we would have been looking, you know, into something, I think, that could have rivaled or exceeded the Great Depression. You know, I didn't have time to be afraid during the day, but at night when I would wake up, I was looking into the abyss because the system was so concentrated that if the system had collapsed, it was hard to figure out how you'd ever put it back together again.
Now, if you look at the business pages of the newspaper, you'd think that the crash of 2008 was, I don't know, the Peloponnesian War, ancient history. Economic growth has been strong for years, and we've been adding an impressive number of jobs by anyone's estimation. But 2008 still shapes our world right now in the most profound ways. And in two ways specifically. One is the rise of right-wing populism that brought us Donald Trump. And the other, which might surprise you a little more, is the melting ice caps in the hotter planet, the problem of climate change. We're going to spend this hour exploring how that crash is affecting our lives and how it will continue to affect our lives for a very long time to come. Not long ago, Hank Paulson wrote, looking back at the dark days of the financial crisis in 2008, it's easy to see the similarities between the financial crisis and the climate challenge that we now face. In other words, Paulson sees a profound connection between the markets and climate policies. And after leaving government, he founded a think tank to promote sustainability. Here again is Hank Paulson talking with Adam Davidson.
Can you walk me through why you see so many parallels between the financial crisis of 2007, 2008, and what's going on with our climate?
First of all, I think climate change really poses a huge environmental risk, of course, a huge risk to our ecosystem, the way we live and work. But ultimately, there are big economic risks, very big economic risks. So that's number one. Number two, when you look at the trigger, it's debt in the case of the financial crisis, and it is carbon dioxide, which is in the atmosphere and is growing all the time, that is the going to be the trigger for the climate change risk. They're both created by flawed government policies. Both of these risks tend to hit the most vulnerable the hardest. They place the biggest burden on those with lower incomes, and each of these economic disasters also hit the government hard in terms of fiscal costs, and it's ultimately borne by the taxpayer.
So it's well known that any kind of financial market can have a tendency towards what the great economist Raghuram Rajan at University of Chicago, former central bank head in India, calls prepayment for risk, that you can take big risks, reap the rewards today, and pay the cost in some distant, uncertain future. And to me, that is a way to think about this, that sure, I know in some vague way there might be a cost to pay down the road, but boy, it sure is fun today.
Yes. Congress deals best. Government deals best when there's an immediate crisis. They can see it. So they deal better with short-term rather than long-term events, and better if it's national as opposed to whether it's global or international. That's what makes this climate risk so different from the one we suffered and so much more perverse. When there's a financial crisis, as bad as it is, the government can come in again and clean it up, get rid of the bad debt, right? Carbon dioxide, it's up there. It's essentially up there forever. It's cumulative. And so it doesn't happen immediately. It slowly strangles you. But I really need to point out, we know that there's going to be sea rise. We know there's going to be more storms. We know there are going to be these climate events and these droughts and these forest fires. You don't know when they're going to hit or where they're going to hit, but they are going to hit. And so here it is just extremely important that we take the steps we need to take to adapt and make our economy more resilient and protect our economic security.
Now, Adam, here you have Paulson comparing the debt bubble to the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the environment. Is that a stretch? Is that a good metaphor?
I was surprised when I first read about Paulson's comparison. And then as I thought about it, I thought, well, wow, yeah, there are some very clear similarities. Very important differences, too, which we can get to. But there is this well-documented in the economic literature, psychological literature, this well-documented human pattern of grabbing a benefit today and ignoring or underplaying the great risks down the road. And much like our financial system, our environment really is a product, especially in a modern global industrial economy, it is a product of a whole lot of individual choices and a whole lot of government choices, often made by politicians who themselves have incentives to take advantage of short-term benefits, even if it means long-term costs. And going back to the great game theorist Thomas Schelling, Nobel Prize-winning game theorist, and others, this is a very tough problem to solve. It's very hard to get a large group of people who are having a great time today, even if every one of those people knows that there's a very good chance that tomorrow or 10 years from now, there will be a huge bill to pay.
And having a great time in this case, the comparison is between having a great time spewing carbon monoxide into the air and flying and riding around in cars and using our air conditioners, and at the same time, buying houses on the cheap.
Exactly. I'm planning a trip with my family to Costa Rica. You know, things that feel like good things. These aren't things I should be ashamed of. I'm not profligate. But collectively, they do make us profligate.
Now, you asked Paulson about risk and the idea of getting paid in advance for a risk that might come due later. Is that what the financial markets are supposed to do by nature?
So the thing you want is a very strong but solid regulator. You want financial markets that are properly regulated for exactly these reasons. We know that markets can tend towards instability, towards concentration of risk. And, you know, to put it mildly, that was not what the SEC and other regulators were doing leading up to the housing bubble, and it's not what they're doing right now.
So one of the most obvious ways we can see this all coming together is to focus on South Florida. South Florida was an epicenter of the foreclosure crisis and one of the first places in the country that will go underwater as the sea level continues to rise. So here we see financial crisis and environmental crisis coming together. And the idea of South Florida going underwater is not an if, it's more of a when, I hate to say. So we sent the Radio Hour's Stephen Valentino to Miami.
So I went to Miami and I wound up in this neighborhood called Brickell, which is sort of adjacent to downtown Miami and right on Biscayne Bay. So you have Biscayne Bay with this beautiful bluish-green water facing Miami Beach, facing the port. There are enormous luxury condo buildings sort of on every block. If you look closely at each of the buildings, you can sort of pick out which real estate boom they were constructed in.
So like this Yacht City, I don't know the story behind that building, but my guess would be that was probably built two booms ago.
My tour guide in Brickell was Tom Hudson, who hosts a radio show called The Sunshine Economy on WLRN.
We're coming up on the Jade here.
Yeah.
Can you just describe sort of what
white
it looks
building,
like?
White building, lots of glass. It's kind of these sweeping balconies. This building was built in the last few years of the last housing boom in 2004, 2005. And condominiums here were selling for $700, $800, $900, $1 million. Within 2 years of that high watermark, you saw several dozen condominiums in this building fall into foreclosure or short sale status. And very soon you saw those same condominiums that had been selling for $1 million in 2005, in the summer of 2008, in the fall of 2008, were selling for half that price.
So you use the phrase high watermark to talk about, you know, the last real estate boom here. But isn't this building also facing another sort of imminent high watermark from climate change?
Absolutely, it is. There's Irma video. In September of 2017, when Irma came in, where this entire space here is just flowing with water. And it gets up to about, I'm guessing, about maybe a foot and a half over where we're standing right now. So in the street, it's probably two and a half feet deep. They built it up to create a high spot here, right on the bay, so that the building itself can remain dry from those storm surges. But you're going to have to get a canoe or a kayak in order to have your valet parking.
Brickell is a place where we're already starting to see the realities of climate change. Sea levels are rising. Places like Miami are experiencing stronger storms and hurricanes. There are parts of Miami where water is sort of creeping up just on high tide days into the streets. And yet, as I'm standing here talking to Tom, there are cranes everywhere. Despite all of these realities of climate change, Brickell is experiencing tremendous growth. When you walk around Brickell, there's sort of this clanging machine noise that sort of follows you as you walk around the neighborhood, because there is just so much stuff going on. I mean, it is one of the fastest growing neighborhoods in Miami.
Climate change and the threat of sea level rise, I have not seen any evidence that it is affecting property values in any real substantial way. I think among the reasons why that is the length of time that people are staying in their homes is less. 5 to 7 years on average before they sell. So you're operating ultimately under the greater fool theory. There's somebody who's more of a fool than I that'll pay a little bit more for this.
But isn't the greater fool theory what caused the housing crisis?
It certainly is part of it, yeah.
Right?
Certainly is part of it, yeah. Until you're the last fool.
Right.
In which case, then, you truly are, yeah.
Tom introduced me to this guy, Victor Roldan, who works in risk management for this company, RMS.
Hey, how are you?
Steven.
Steven, hey, nice to meet you.
Good to see you.
Oh, good.
And what RMS does is they tell insurance companies whether or not something is a good bet. And Victor is particularly interested in Brickell because, you know, there's this looming threat of climate change and there's all this construction happening here.
Yeah, you want to see it? All right.
And as it turns out, he lives just up the street.
That's my building right there.
Okay, so just up the street there?
Yeah, yeah. I actually bought this place during the financial collapse.
Yes.
Yes. It was hard to find a bank, so you needed to put a lot of money down, so I had to put all my savings to it, and I bought very cheap in a very beautiful place. Yes.
So how did you feel seeing all of that water come in from your living room window?
Well, yeah, the first when you see that is quite impressive. And then you start analyzing, making assessment, okay, all right. So we're in the business of transferring risk. So we help companies how to transfer the risk. And that's what it's all about. You know, the builder here built this and then he makes some money, he transferred the risk to the owners. Now we're trying to transfer the risk to an insurance company. That's perhaps why you don't see like a major impact on this. It's, nobody's really worried because the risk is so distributed against many companies around the world.
I mean, this idea of transfer of risk, wasn't that sort of something that happened during the housing crisis?
Yeah, very similar.
Right, exactly. This idea that like, oh, we can write these mortgages and then we'll package them and sell them off to someone else and then...
Yes.
So what lessons do you draw from that in sort of applying?
Well, so there's going to be a point where sea level is so high that the insurance companies are going to say, I'm not going to protect the mortgage. And then the owners like me, we have to go and find who's going to protect us. You know, at some point I say, okay, I will sell my apartment and move to higher ground as well. And let's see, somebody will pay for the property what I pay, you know?
So when you're thinking about moving for personal reasons and maybe for climate reasons, will it be a profitable investment?
It will be. It will be a profitable investment, yes. Yeah, it will be a profitable investment.
So Victor is very sure that his apartment is going to lose value because of climate change. And so the plan is to sell it before that happens. A lot of people in Brickell are sort of following this model. And what that means is that at some point, a lot of people are going to be left with houses that might be underwater in terms of value, but will also be literally underwater.
I mean, when I was coming down here, I read a think tank report that said that by 2050, about $23 billion of real estate in Florida could be underwater.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how would that compare to the 2008 housing crisis?
It would be devastating. It would be cataclysmic for those homeowners and for the ripple effect that would take place. Because if you've got a $1 million property here, think of the property taxes that throws off to the county government, to the local school district, to the state government. And so if that value destruction hits because of rising seas, it's not just the property owner here at the Jade that's going to be impacted by it. It's the entire South Florida economy, by extension, the Florida economy, and conceivably by extension, the national economy. As Florida being the third most populous state, it is a place with great wealth, certainly, and generates a lot of federal tax revenue as it does for the state government.
So is it going to take for like a change in thinking here?
Yeah.
Is it going to take a signal from, say, the insurance industry to say,
yes,
we are not writing policies for buildings built 2 feet above the waterline?
I've contended for years that in order for any community, any industry, any neighborhood, any government, frankly, to take the threat of climate change seriously, it's going to take the financial community to put a price on it. be that either through more accurately priced flood insurance to higher cost of mortgage. I've heard financial professionals think about creating a kind of home mortgage that works similar to an auto loan. The moment you sign the paper for your car loan and drive that car off the lot, it begins to decrease in value. It's a wasting asset. Do we need to reconceive of our underlying concept of home ownership as an asset that is going to be devalued over time?
For homeowners like Victor and a lot of developers in South Florida, this model makes perfect sense. It may be a short-term model, but it is a model that works for them. And, you know, you can make a lot of money. I mean, if you time it right, you can make a lot of money.
Same thing here. And they have some incredible plans, build hotels over there. I mean, it's a beautiful place to live, you know?
But, like, with the projections of what's expected to happen here...
you transfer your risk. You build in 3 years, 4 or 5 years, and then you're out. You transfer your risk.
Sure, you transfer the risk, but at some point, someone is left holding the bag.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, it's like a pyramid scheme, you know? Who's the last one? You don't want to be the last one. Yes.
Stephen Valentino in Florida with Victor Roldan, a risk assessor. And we heard from Tom Hudson, who hosts a program called The Sunshine Economy for WLRN in Miami. Today we're looking at the financial crisis of 2008 and how it affected the climate crisis of right now, two catastrophes for the price of one, only on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remy. In some parts of the country right now, that sound, hydraulic drills and compressors used in fracking, is a constant presence. In Texas, the Dakotas, Pennsylvania, and other places too, fracking has given us an energy boom. It's made the U.S. into the world's leading producer of oil and gas by some estimates. Fracking, of course, has been controversial. It creates a lot of methane, which is a greenhouse gas. It's been blamed for poisoning water tables and other environmental consequences. Eliza Griswold's been writing a lot on the fracking industry, and she's discovered that it's controversial in other ways as well. Here's Eliza.
I've been looking into fracking for 7 years. I've been in people's farms and in their backyards, looking at the human costs of America's energy boom. One of the things about fracking that has always been true is that for the companies, it's very expensive.
The key ingredient in fracking isn't so much chemicals as it is capital. It was an extraordinarily expensive proposition.
That's Bethany McLean. She's a financial journalist who brought down Enron, and she's written a new book, Saudi America. One of Bethany's key insights is that fracking wouldn't have been possible without the 2008 financial crisis. What happened is that the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates dramatically, and that made borrowing money very cheap. That meant companies could raise money hand over fist. And fracking companies, many of which weren't really turning a profit, were suddenly awash in cash just because the cost of borrowing money was so low. Jim Chanos, a very well-known hedge fund manager, agrees that this was the moment critical to the industry.
There was no way this would have happened on the scale it had without Wall Street embracing it and willingly providing capital to this industry.
Growth in this industry has been remarkable. Tens of thousands of wells have gone in all over the country. Hundreds of thousands of miles of pipeline crisscross the landscape. If you look at all of this infrastructure that has sprung up as a result of easy money, you could say that fracking is a monument to the 2008 financial crisis. So I met with Bethany and Jim, not at some rural well site, but where the action really happens, in a swank office in Midtown Manhattan. So fracking was initially sold as an environmental positive, that it would be a bridge fuel to cleaner energy economy. Did that turn out to be the case?
So I think it's complicated. I think natural gas, there's some arguments that it is a cleaner fuel because of because it's replacing coal and thereby lowering carbon emissions. But as the frackers produce so much natural gas that they totally crush the price of natural gas, they instead switch to oil. And so most of the value in fracking, or most of what people think about with fracking today, is not so much natural gas. It's actually oil.
As Bethany points out, the frackers have been so successful in producing natural gas prices that they collapsed the price. And so it is very cheap, and a lot of it's just simply flared off these days, not even used.
Mm-hmm. So a crisis is always an opening for new ways of thinking. And Jim, where did you and others of your contemporaries, where did your associates see opportunities after the crash in energy?
So I began to educate myself and my team here on the economics of fracking and how it was different from, say, the integrated oil business. When Exxon would drill a deep well after a lot of testing, they were pretty certain that if they said the well had probably a 20 to 40 year life, it probably had a 20 to 40 year life. And that once the well was drilled, it was annual maintenance and worker salaries, whatever, to keep the rig going. It was different in the fracking. There, because the nature of the technology, the energy was released at the front end of your drilling process and then declined rapidly. It meant that you had to keep putting more and more money in to keep your production even steady.
So, Jim, you started seeing flaws in the numbers in 2010.
We were starting to see evidence in Chesapeake and some of the others, the earlier frackers, that if you just did some calculations and you realized how much money they were reinvesting back in the business, it should have yielded even more production than it was. And so what it meant to us basically was that they were overstating profits. And so it had this vicious cycle, because what happened was money flooded in, not only because of the Federal Reserve's easy policy, but because the companies looked better than they really were. They've managed to convince Wall Street, typically on the back of a lot of debt raised, that 2 + 2 = 5. And Wall Street loves that equation.
The most famous example from that is actually before the crisis. It's from the bankruptcy of WorldCom back in the early 2000s. And the WorldCom scandal essentially was WorldCom taking all of the costs that should have been running through its income statement and figuring out ways to put them on its balance sheet instead, so that its reported profits looked much, much better than they were. And that was the essence of the WorldCom fraud. And that's probably the most famous one you can point to. Am I wrong?
And the CEO is still in prison doing that.
Wow. Why don't we call it accounting fraud when it comes to fracking?
It's a good question.
Well, sometimes things are only accounting fraud after a bankruptcy, right? So that's one issue. But accounting is an art rather than a science, and there's an awful lot of latitude in it. So sometimes things you can look at and say are misleading are not necessarily something that a prosecutor would find illegal.
One other little thing to note on this, and it's you find these things in the places that are sort of a little harder to look. One of the reasons that kept us attracted to this industry as short sellers is all the ways in which the fracking management was able to enrich itself off the top, if you will. Often management, you had to look at their incentive compensation and how they were paid. And in many cases, it was on production, which is kind of an important point, because even when it was uneconomic to produce, if they could raise money, they would produce, because their bonus pool would be bigger based on production, not profitability.
Bethany, you have been really careful to say that the verdict is still out on fracking, but you've also described fracking as an unintentional Ponzi scheme. What do you mean by that? And what are the consequences for the future? Because eventually all Ponzi schemes collapse.
There are some companies that are making some money today. And so to me, the key question isn't so much the financial one. It's actually kind of the more existential one. If the companies stop being funded by this avalanche of cheap capital, how much energy can they actually produce? How much oil and gas can they actually produce? How the good acreage there, the really key acreage in the core, how far does that extend? And so to me, that's the key question is what will this be revealed to be eventually? I don't know from a financial standpoint that it ever becomes a calamity, but it becomes a calamity if we depend on this oil and gas and think it's going to grow forever. I think Jim may have a slightly more skeptical take than I do.
Well, as you know, we did just a look back at the last 5 years of the industry. And the reason that was sort of convenient was it took us over a period of better and better fracking technology, but prices that were very high, that went very low, and are back to high. The 5 years also coincides with basically the average life of one of these wells. And the figure was negative for the entire industry. So for the entire industry, in a complete cycle, price cycle, in fracking, and it was uneconomic. It was free cash flow negative for the investors. And so Wall Street will be willing to overlook that when times are good, but when they get fearful, they shut off capital.
So is there a parallel then to be made between fracking now and mortgages in the 2000s?
I think there is a parallel to be made in that during a bubble, capital can be put to uses that in retrospect will clearly be seen to be uneconomic, right? And so in the run-up to the financial crisis, you had banks, lenders making mortgages to people who didn't have a hope of paying them back. And afterwards you say, how could that have happened? And there's an explanation for it, but most of it was a mania. People forgot about the idea that somebody had to pay the money back. And so I think there's an analogy to this today when I get asked the question, why on earth would Wall Street fund these guys? This is uneconomic. You must be wrong. I say, no, just look at the history of Wall Street. They funded plenty of things that are uneconomic at the end of the day. And you realize Wall Street's incredibly short term. The idea that they're going to be taking into account something that might happen even in a decade is just, it's beyond the reach of today's capital markets, I think.
That's Bethany McLean. Her new book on the fracking economy is called Saudi America. We also heard from hedge fund manager Jim Chanos. They spoke with Eliza Griswold, who writes about fracking and politics and many other subjects for The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick, and I'm here with our ace financial reporter, Adam Davidson. We're talking about the connections between the 2008 financial crisis and the climate crisis. Bethany McLean and others link fracking very directly to the crash of 2008, which seems ironic because the stimulus package was supposed to be very, very strong on renewable energies. Green jobs was a major theme as Obama sold the recovery to the American people. What happened to all that?
So whenever you essentially pump huge amounts of money into an economy, you know, the Federal Reserve was doing that through its central bank mechanisms. The government was doing that through its stimulus programs. Those were necessary at the time. They really were. And they prevented our lives from being dramatically worse. But you're truly inevitably going to create perverse outcomes. You're going to create bubbles somewhere out there. Also, the way the stimulus was adjusted because of Republican opposition made it even more of a transfer to incumbent industries. They tried to put in a little bit of stuff for green energy. I don't think it was very well designed.
In terms of the amount or in terms of where it was directed?
A lot of the green energy and specifically green jobs programs were very poorly designed. There's something called Pathways Out of Poverty that it was just an ugly, kludgy device that tried to get very, very poor people to be trained to insulate homes. I did a lot of reporting on it. It was a disaster. But a $900 billion stimulus, or a little less, a $90 billion or so of it focus on green energy, you know, there's probably more weatherized homes and more solar panels in America today, which is probably a good thing. But they were very expensive programs that didn't really have the stimulative impact we wanted. I'd say this goes back to the fundamental thing that's not what we need. That's not enough. And what many Democrat-leaning economists and Republican-leaning economists believe in a carbon tax. It's a very simple thing. Carbon costs society some amount. We don't know exactly how much, but we can estimate it pretty well. And we should tax companies for the carbon they emit. This is an idea a lot of Democrats like, but Hank Paulson, who's like the poster child for mainstream Republican economic views, he's a huge fan. And I talked to him about it last week. I remember when you were named Treasury Secretary, it was my job at NPR to do the quick, who's this Hank Paulson fellow story. And so I had to kind of do a quick biography of you. And it was a bit hard to map you onto existing political dynamics because you are a Republican, or you were at the time. Do you still consider yourself a Republican?
I consider myself to be a classic old-style Republican.
So I'm going to take that as a no.
And you're right. I've always been interested in conservation. I've always been interested in the environment. That I had come out very early and recommending putting a price on carbon, okay, carbon emissions. It's a pollutant, and we don't tax it. A matter of fact, we do the opposite. There are tax incentives and other incentives for developing and using carbon-based fuels. So that is very, very perverse. It's probably not best politically to call it a carbon tax. You could call it a carbon fee, call it anything you want. But if you put
I would call it the jobs bill.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's a good idea, the jobs bill.
Yeah.
Because what it will do is it ultimately will create more jobs. The costs may come early. There'll be jobs lost in some areas, but there'll be a lot of jobs created where we rebuild infrastructure. But what that does is it changes behavior, consumer behavior, investor behavior. We won't have to pick winners. I don't believe that the government should be saying we pick solar or we pick wind. The market will pick them if we eliminate the subsidies which we are giving. And I don't understand any basis for giving subsidies for oil or coal or any carbon-based fuels. It's not like there's any shortage of them. It's not like these are new industries. Even if someone didn't believe in the climate risk, it's just a waste of dollars. All you need to do is take away the incentives to invest in fossil fuels and create a level playing field.
Hank Paulson talking with The New Yorker's Adam Davidson. Paulson makes it sound, I don't want to say easy, but at least possible to make some headway against climate change without the kind of massive job loss that would cripple our economy either. With Democrats taking control of the House of Representatives, it's conceivable, just conceivable, that a carbon tax, or as Adam prefers to call it, the jobs bill, could at least be up for discussion. But it's never going to pass under this president. But we have to note that climate change is already happening. It's with us right now as the atmosphere heats up, extreme weather becomes more frequent, more destructive, and very often the people affected most severely are the ones who can least afford it. When Hurricane Harvey dumped a monstrous 40 inches of rain on southeast Texas, some 30,000 people were evacuated, and among them was a Houston woman named Felicia Byrd. And a year later, despite the efforts of aid agencies, she's still waiting to get back on her feet.
I had just got released from the hospital when the flood came. And I was staying at an extended care for 30 days. During that 30 days is when the storm took place. So when my time was up there, I couldn't go back home because I had lost everything. After that, I went to a place called George R. Brown Convention Center. They had everything. Everything. They even had a Walmart set up inside the convention center. And all this stuff was free. The actual physical situation, no, it wasn't good. It was extremely cold. Extremely cold. So I stayed there for like 2 months. After that, actually what happened, because I would leave sometime for 2 or 3 days and go to a relative's, mainly my daughter's. And the last time I left and went to her house, when I came back, they had moved all my stuff. So I had to go to a temporary shelter. Now that, I'm going to be honest, that was horrible. And I stayed there 2 days. And, I mean, it was horrible. Horrible. So 2 days after that, they brought us to a shelter called Residence of Emancipation. So some of us qualified for a housing program. And this apartment complex facility is what was open, and it's called New Hope Housing. So I've been in New Hope Housing now for 6 months. My plan now, I hope to one day be able to live on the southwest side of Houston. That's where the majority of my family live, even though parts of that city did flood bad. I don't know much about piping and drainage and all that, but I know we have a lot of bios. So I'm not really scared, but I keep in the back of my mind that it can happen. It can happen again. I've had to start over for because of floods. I was part of the Allison flood in 2001. I was part of the Ike flood in 2008. Starting over is hard, you know. So I'm just going to just see how this goes.
That's Felicia Byrd in Houston. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. I'm David Remnick. This entire hour, we've been looking back at the financial crisis of 2008. At its consequences in American politics and in the global environment, and how those two things are related. George Packer is the author of the book, The Unwinding. He's thought as deeply about America and why we find ourselves divided so sharply as anyone writing today. So, George, you've spent a lot of time thinking about, reporting on, writing about the 2008-2009 financial crisis. What is the link between that epical event, the financial crisis, and the Trump presidency?
I think it's a fairly straight line because the financial crisis destroyed large numbers of middle-class people's faith in government, in banks, in the housing market, in their retirement funds, in job security. All the things that were like the basis of middle-class security were gone almost overnight for a lot of Americans. And it created a sense of, what do I have to do to have a good life here? I thought I was doing everything right, and it's all been taken away. Who took it away from me?
George, one of the things we're looking at is the connections between the financial crisis and climate change. Climate change is one of the irreversible aspects of the Trump presidency. He pulled us out of the Paris Accord. He has infused his party with disbelief in science and the conclusions of scientists. It's also an issue that Trump uses as a wedge. Why is climate change denialism a winning political issue for the party and for him?
I think for two reasons. One, it's a great way to stick it to liberals. Al Gore was the first major spokesman in politics sounding the alarm bell. What a great target for a Republican politician. And so it just became, in the tribal political world we live in, another way to bash them. But it also is ideal because climate change is just an entire loser for everybody. It just means you have to give things up. It means you have to change your lifestyle. You can't, you know, drive the car you want. You can't use the amount of energy you want. You can't.
You have to spend trillions of dollars to ameliorate the situation.
Exactly, to build seawalls, et cetera. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could just convince yourself that it was a hoax?
Well, when you were traveling, and it wasn't just in Florida, you were all over the country to report this book, and you've reported from all over the country for The New Yorker for years. How do people talk about climate change that are not in Brooklyn or San Francisco or wherever you might be?
Well, I'll give you an example. One of the main characters in The Unwinding is a guy named Dean Price, who's a North Carolina biodiesel entrepreneur who really believed that the depressed rural economy of North Carolina would be brought back by making diesel fuel out of canola on former tobacco fields. So he had an environmental vision. But when I asked him about global warming, he said, you know, maybe you're the one who believes in magic because you don't – do you understand the science of it? Have you – are you enough of a scientist to – and I had to admit, no, I'm trusting scientists who do have the credentials.
Right. You didn't know how to get to the moon either.
Right. Right. But I trust them that they know what they're talking about. And he was sort of impeaching me for being credulous about science. And I thought, well, Dean believes in science. Why is he making an exception on this issue? And –
because it's exceptionally painful.
I think it's just too much for us to take in. And you and I don't really take it. I mean, if we lived every day of our lives thinking about this all the time, it would be so paralyzing and we'd be so unable to turn a light switch on that life would be untenable.
When you look at the wreckage of 2008, 2009, and you look at our current politics, and then ahead to what's in store for climate change and nationally and globally, what's to be done in the world, the real world of politics? What's the way out? Is there a way out?
So not long ago, I wrote a piece for the magazine about Ryan Costello, who's a Republican from Pennsylvania, retiring from Congress, young, who's a conservative about many things, voted for the tax cut. But on global warming, he is quite adamant that we have to, you know, do something about carbon emissions, et cetera. I don't know all of his policy views, but for him, this issue is crucial, and obviously for his constituents in suburban Philadelphia who know about it and who believe in it. Republicans like him need to get some foothold in their own party. We cannot have a single party addressing this issue. It has to be the whole country. And as you're telling me, 30% to 40% of Americans don't believe in man-made climate change.
But what I'm also telling you, and it's a horrendous thing to say, is too late. Too late.
Yeah.
In certain respects. I mean, it's never too late to ameliorate the situation and to do better than we could. But in many ways, what we could have done 20 years ago is now an opportunity lost.
You're right. So we'll end up doing what? Moving communities away from the coast, building seawalls, trying to find, you know, answers to
And facing problems of whether or not this country is still capable of or wants to help the poor in other parts of the world.
Which is, at this point, unthinkable. I mean,
that's who's going to get hit the worst.
And they will want to come here and to Europe, as they do now, but in greater numbers. And our sympathies will be, you know, even more corroded because we'll be struggling with things ourselves and our politicians will be telling us we can't afford it and we don't want them. And it's a pretty dark picture.
George, we've heard conspiracy theories having to do with the financial crisis, its origins, and the way we went about trying to fix it. We've heard now conspiracy theories for decades about the truth or falseness of climate change. Does one conspiracy theory feed on itself, lead to the next one? Does it erode matters?
Yeah. I think once you've assured yourself that the experts don't know what they're talking about because they got the Iraq war wrong and they got the economy wrong and they got all kinds of things wrong, then sure, why not everything, including the hardest thing, which is climate change? Climate change might be the original conspiracy theory of our time. Obviously, there have been legions in the past, but the original one of our time that kind of softened up the ground for all the others, because it really did begin with the Republican Party under George W. Bush mocking Al Gore and the other ringers of the alarm bell. So that made it thinkable that everything else that the experts say might be wrong.
George Packer, thank you.
Thank you, David.
Politics, our economy, and our environment, they're all interconnected. And what we're seeing here is that we can't fix any one of these things without tackling all three to some extent. Adam Davidson, our financial reporter, is with us. Adam, we have the president that we have, at least for another couple of years, and whose attitude toward the financial system, whose attitude toward the toward climate change is what it is, and it is unlikely to change. It's unlikely to change. What can be done right now, whether it has to do with the financial system, which we've been discussing, or climate change and their interaction, that could cause us to be setting a better course? And certainly without Trump in the picture after 2 years, what could be done to set a better course? You mentioned, of course, a carbon tax. What else?
So, first of all, I think that the American presidency is a uniquely powerful office, and there is no real solution without having an American president who embraces the necessity for that change. There's some opportunities to build coalitions between the U.S. and civil society and Europe and China, and the citizens have to take this on ourselves, and not just by marching, although marching's not a problem, but by really fleshing out the tangible solutions. We've seen that in other areas. We've seen that in the civil rights struggle. We've seen that in the gay rights struggle. We've seen that in a million areas where
the frustration, of course, is in the civil rights struggle. You had a president who was susceptible to pressure. That the march on Selma happened, the violence in Selma happened, and it affected Lyndon Johnson, and Lyndon Johnson was able to leverage that in Congress. You don't have that political situation now.
To me, the fundamental difference between the financial crisis and the environmental crisis comes down to that. With the financial crisis, Henry Paulson had something that we don't have yet with the environmental crisis. He had a day. It was a Thursday morning where he was able to get the leaders of Congress. He was able to get everyone into a room and say, if you do X, Y, and Z, we will save the world. If you don't, the world will end. Your call. And it was sharp and specific, and the pressure was unimaginable.
The difference is that when we see hurricanes in Florida, when we see the southern tip of Manhattan practically underwater, we can somehow, or if the politicians are like Donald Trump, they can somehow flip it around and say that this has nothing to do with climate
change. Yeah, and by then it's too late. I mean, I think a lot of people see the recent UN report. A lot of people see the hurricane season as we're there now. We are getting the message. It's time. But not enough people are getting that. And it's not going to come down to this decision on this day. And what we seem to know is politicians and lots of people are not good at taking important action about the future unless there is that kind of signal. Do it today or we all die.
Adam Davidson is a staff writer at The New Yorker. We've been looking at the financial crisis of 2008, the ongoing climate crisis, and how those things are somehow connected. Now, to get the long view on this, the really long view, we turn to Jill Lepore. Jill is a staff writer at the magazine and a historian at Harvard University. And she's just written a big, excellent history of the United States, These Truths. In Jill's view, this kind of short-term thinking that we've been talking about and complaining about is no accident. It's actually baked into our democracy.
The federal constitution is our really only long-term plan. Everything else is running for office. Everything else is election-driven. Everything else has an incredibly short time horizon. When there has been more long-term planning, it's come from people who don't hold elected office. So thinking about maybe, you know, Alexander Hamilton's economic planning in the 1790s, which is a kind of blueprint for economic development in the new nation that is going to take decades to really see results. Long-term planning comes from other sources. It can come from party strategists, it can come from cabinet members, it can come from social movements. Think about the campaign to end lynching. It takes decades and decades and decades and decades, and it takes change coming from all quarters. It takes muckraking journalism. It takes rallies. It takes marches. It takes legislative act after legislative act. But it also takes a very big public conversation and a reckoning with the costs and a sense of what it does to all of us to live in a world of violence. And that kind of stirring massive political change, the nature of our public conversation about climate change, really hasn't happened yet. But there's no reason it can't happen now. But with climate change, you know, as Adam suggests, if there isn't a single moment, an hour of a particular day on a calendar year where the disaster is suddenly witnessed and illuminated and the urgency is suddenly manifest, then really I think you're maybe looking to sources of change that are outside of the federal government. I mean, I guess reform within the private sector would be the place where you could most easily imagine long-term planning in the national interest that also happens to align with the interests of every corporation making some headway. So a carbon tax is a really important proposal for addressing climate change, a very rational proposal. And you can consider the federal income tax. A graduated federal income tax was a very rational idea that took decades to earn the support that it needed to go to Congress and then to go to the states for ratification. It required a constitutional amendment. Carbon tax doesn't require a constitutional amendment. It requires a sense of common purpose. And it requires reaching across different political constituencies so that people can understand our shared, if unequal, burden.
Common purpose and shared burden. If we leave you with any takeaways from this program today, let it be those. Jill Lepore is the author of These Truths, A New History of the United States, and she's a staff writer for The New Yorker. That's our show for today. I'm David Remnick, and I want to thank you for joining me. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.